This is Mark Kilby, and I am probably the best at doing all the things you should not do in Agile. Or I could say something like, to take a Mythbusters approach, this is Mark Kilby, and I reject your Agile reality and insert my own.
Hello, welcome to another edition of the Agile Uprising podcast. I'm Andy Clef, and my co-host today is Colleen Johnson. Hello.
Hello.
Good to see you guys. So we have Zoom going, so we have panels and videos, and for you in the listening audience, we'll do some screen grabs for you. And we are so delighted that we're joined today by two wonderful guests, Joanna Rothman and Mark Kilby. Joanna, this is your third podcast. You've come back. You've had two. You suffered through Jay. Shout out to Jay. For December and January, Future of Agile, Create Your Successful Agile Project. Thank you so much for coming back.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I am an avid listener, so I listen to all your podcasts.
We haven't scared you away yet.
No, not yet.
And Mark, a warm first-timer welcome. You're an Agile coach, a mentor, a fellow Happy Melly supporter. You contribute frequently to the Agile Uprising Coalition. What else shall the world know about you today?
Well, I also try to contribute back to the community. So I started with Agile by practicing in nonprofit organization because it was difficult to practice at work. So now, several years later, I try to give back to those nonprofit organizations and help them with Agile approaches as well. So involved in several.
So you're very active down in Orlando. I see a lot of meetups that you organize. It's a wonderful thing how you give back and support Agile as a mindset, both locally and globally. So thanks for doing that.
Thanks, Andy. And good to be here.
You guys just finished up a new book, From Chaos to Successful Distributed Agile Teams, and we'll include in the show notes links to Lean Pub. Joanna's holding up the cover with a great big smile. Why'd you write this book now? What was the catalyst?
So at Agile 2017, I was walking to the last session on Friday morning, and Mark and I ended up walking together, and I said, Mark, I've been thinking about a book about geographically distributed Agile teams. Want to write it with me?
So that's not actually what happened.
It's not?
No. Now for the alternate facts.
So I'll tell the true story. So what Joanna said is, because I had been in one of her writing courses, she knew a little bit about my writing and said, when are you going to write a book on distributed Agile teams? And knowing several authors, I immediately cringed because I heard all the horror stories about trying to put a book together. And then Joanna asked, well, you know, I've been thinking about writing one myself. Would you like to pair? It took me about a tenth of a millisecond to respond to that question. I just said, yes, let's do it.
We had not seen anything really useful at that conference. And in 2017, you know, let's just stop saying you have to be co-located. We cannot be co-located. We have to be able to work anywhere.
Yeah, and I think I've seen a few publications focused on successful distributed teams, but none really targeted towards Agile. And like you just said, there's a principle that says we need to be co-located. So I'm excited to dig into some of your recommendations here for how to be successful at both being distributed and being Agile.
Well, there's also sort of a overarching principle that we should always inspect and adapt. And I always thought it funny that people didn't want to try to adapt to this environment, especially that it is starting to improve. So it was not perfect when the Agile Manifesto was created. It definitely was painful then. It's not nearly as painful now and doesn't have to be.
Yeah. Well, so often people shy away because they're just frustrated, because they refuse to adapt and they keep trying the same old practices in a completely different system. Mm-hmm. So kudos for doing that. So unpack for us a little bit the target audiences that you considered, that the user personas as your readers, as you sat down and wrote this book.
So there were a few. Certainly the teams and the team leaders, and we use that very broadly. It could be a scrum master, it could be a coach, it could be a product owner, it could be a team lead, but somebody who is trying to get this team to work well and might even care about the people on this team, so they're not suffering with crazy hours and trying to work together. Some subsets of that are, it could be a team that had previously been co-located, but now parts of them have become distributed, or they are a distributed team and members of that team had worked in other Agile teams and starting to wonder, can we make this work? Can we make things better by applying Agile principles and practices? And so that was one audience. I'll let Johanna talk about the other one.
So the other one is the managers and executives, because we see a lot of, I think it's more generous to call them misconceptions about knowledge work in general and about distributed knowledge work. Is there a way to actually create a team? And yes, the answer is yes. And we need the mindset shift changes. We need to think about flow efficiency. There's a lot of things that we really need to think about. So you all know me as the manager geek, and that I firmly lived up to that when we wrote this book.
So the arguments that you guys make for distributed teams are pretty powerful. It gives us the ability or an organization to hire talented people anywhere in the world, or to retain talented people that need to move for some family change. Another point that was really great is you create a very resilient workforce that can continue on in spite of any environmental catastrophes, from road closures to bad weather to hurricanes, right? That prevent you from getting to a spot. And also things as simple as quality of life to allow people to avoid horrendous commutes. Why? So there's that great, powerful argument for, yes, distributed teams work. Let's dive into why Agile for distributed teams? What's the mindset? What are some of the changes that need to happen to allow this system, as you said it, Johanna, to flow? What's the mindset of collaboration? How is it different?
I would actually start with a different mindset first, which is a mindset for change, managing for change and experiments. Because if we think about the idea of how do we want to encourage change, not just in the product, but in the team. And we are not saying change everybody on the team every 30 seconds. We are definitely not saying that. But if we think about how do we change our approaches, not just what we do in the product, then I think that we're a lot more successful.
Another mindset change is to focus more on Agile principles over practices. So where we see people stumble is they realize, those who've been successful with Agile realize it is about collaboration, it is about communication, and that's what can help a distributed team work together better, is that emphasis on communication and collaboration that Agile approaches bring. Where they stumble is they try to copy-paste, in a way, the practices, and it does not work. Instead, you need to look at what are some of the principles behind some of the practices. So for instance, the idea of a stand-up. So in a co-located setting, you know, a stand-up is for the team to quickly get together, check in on where everybody's at. Are we still moving toward the same goal? Are we going to deliver value? And then, you know, break, we're done. That is not exactly the same on a distributed team, because in a distributed team, the team members may not be able to connect with each other continually throughout the day. So there's other aspects that you might have team members join early. You might have them stay on a little bit later in a stand-up, but it's not just about the stand-up. It's more about the socialization, allowing a little more socialization time around that meeting, or really any meeting, so they can connect, check in with each other. And so that allows people to really realize that, oh, we're people, we're not automatons. So we should check in and make sure we do this. And actually, Johanna and I wrote the book, that was something we did as almost a daily practice in our writing, is we would do short check-ins with each other, see, how are you doing? Are you feeling up to doing certain kinds of work or other kinds of work based on, you know, how your day was going?
So for those who haven't had a chance to read the book, and I forget it's in the foreword or the end notes, you guys drank your own champagne. You were a two-person fully distributed team writing this book together, synchronously sometimes and asynchronously others.
I would say mostly synchronous. So, but I'll let Johanna go into more of that.
Yeah, for the words, it was totally synchronous. So we pair wrote this entire book together as a pair, as a distributed pair, when I was in Israel. Was I ever in any other place? I'm not sure if I was in Las Vegas once.
Some of the conferences where you were a couple time zones off and we could meet early.
Yeah, I'm sure I was in Dallas at one point. We did not pair draw, although we did a lot of feedback on the drawing because we didn't have a really good tool for drawing together. But we every word in this book and every word in the drawings, we pair wrote.
Yeah. So one would drive the keyboard, the other would navigate. So that could be spelling checks, typos. Sometimes that could be sitting there and trying to understand what the heck the other person just wrote, because it wasn't that clear sometimes.
You mentioned the difference here between working synchronously and asynchronously. For agile teams, do you find that one method is more successful than the other in helping them?
So I am a huge fan of pairing and swarming and mobbing. Huge, huge. And that means that it's much better for team members to have more hours of overlap so they can collaborate like that. If people have about 4 hours of overlap during the day, and notice that this is not time zone differences, because people might shift their preferred time of working, as we did, right? We sometimes shifted, but we created enough overlap that we had time every single day to write. And when teams have enough time together as a team, they are quite successful, especially with any collaborative practice.
What do you do when there isn't sufficient hours of overlap? How do you avoid the chaos or the transfer, the wait times?
So that's what chapter 3 is all about in the book. And Mark and I went back and forth on, do we actually say, don't use an agile approach? And we finally said, yeah, we're going to tell them. Don't try and use a collaborative, team-based approach if you don't have the possibility of creating a collaborative team. Just don't do it.
Yeah, in other words, don't make somebody do a stand-up at 3 o'clock in the morning their local time. Why is that a good idea? That it's not. So there are limitations. And we're not saying that distributed is for everyone and for all teams. There are boundaries.
Well, unpack that some more. So besides lack of time overlap, when would agile and or distributed teams not be a good fit?
I know that certain frameworks emphasize cross-functional teams, but I find in general they work well no matter what approach you're taking. If you cannot get sufficient overlap amongst the different functions to get different perspectives on the problem, that is definitely one challenge that you have. Another would be where maybe your product owner or product manager or whatever role you have for keeping a focus on how are we delivering value and what priority, if that person or role is far removed from the team, that could be another huge challenge, as I'm sure all of you have have encountered.
And I got to add my favorite. My personal favorite is, we'll save money by moving some functions to lower cost countries, which is, and Colleen, you know about cycle time. Thank God you are the cycle time queen on this podcast. Every time you say cycle time, I say, yay, Colleen. Yeah, okay, stop. But I do. I listen to you on my walk, so I'm always saying, yay, Colleen. The neighbors think I'm totally nuts, which I am. That's fine. So trying to save money with lower salaries when the cycle time extends and extends and extends, nuts. It's just nuts. And too many managers don't see that.
Right. And when we talk about, you know, the kind of the origins of lean thinking, right, the respect for humans and the fact that humans are the people doing the work is a core tenet of lean thinking that I think gets lost when we try to draw the dotted line back to manufacturing and thinking of an assembly line. And this is something you guys talk about in the book. So you have, you know, these principles to support distributed agile teams. And you mentioned not thinking of people as cogs. Start thinking them of they're people. They're humans with lives and families and things to do other than potentially stand up at 3 a.m., right?
Oh, yeah.
Some of the other principles you talk about are full transparency, and I wanted to dig into that one a little bit about what things you recommend for teams to create full transparency in a distributed setting.
So if we start with just plain product-based transparency, there's a lot of teams that somehow the product owner or God forbid an architect parcels out the work, and people don't actually understand the context of all the work that they're supposed to do. I don't understand how an agile team can work that way. So for us, I mean, we have this really nice principle with no team transparency on one side and full corporate transparency on the other. And what we often find is, at least if there is product-based transparency, what do we have to do as a team? What's our product strategy? What are our roadmaps? Do we have blockers that people know about? That might be totally fine for any given team and to use a variety of agile teams in the organization. I might like more transparency as a person in the organization. So let me just share with you, Mark sees my various dashboards because we have the book up on many platforms. I have been totally transparent with him about where we are selling the book, how many books we sell where, and I still have to update spreadsheets because one of us is a little slow, but he gets to see all of that, right? So I am sharing, I am creating transparency around our intellectual property.
And I can also say I get to see some of the flow of her other 13 books, and it makes my head spin. So
a little too much work in progress, Joanna.
A little too much transparency. But to go back to the transparency at a team level, sometimes it's as simple as when you integrate a new team member, it's setting some simple practices in place, saying ask questions in open channels. So I do this all the time as we get new people on board. When they come into the organization, they want to send direct messages to somebody because they don't want to ask a dumb question. And I always tell them, there is no such thing. I said, you're actually going to help the team. And we say this in the book, because if you ask that question, you'll see 3, 4, 5, sometimes 10 different answers pop up. And then you'll see the rest of the team go, oh, I didn't know you could do that. Wait, tell me more about that. And you see the team start to reorient around the knowledge and then say, okay, new person on the team, gather all this, put it in the wiki. We now have an update in the team's knowledge base. So.
And that is a beautiful collaborative approach. However, a precondition is psychological safety, which can be difficult even when you're all in the same room, let alone across cultures, geographies, time zones, and organizations. What are some things that you guys have played with that have both worked and not worked to build that open, transparent, not just from a product, but from a heart point of view, to allow people to say, I need help, and I'm going to ask for it in, as you say, Mark, an open channel?
As part of that, it's starting right from the first time, not only when they begin to enter the organization, but sometimes even when they start interviewing. So even in the interview process, sometimes what I'll do is we tend to interview in teams, which is not uncommon, but depending on where I am in the team, if I'm in the middle of the interview team or later, I'll just say, you know what? You've talked to a bunch of people. You probably had a bunch of questions fired at you. Why don't you ask me some questions? I want you to ask anything, and I'll tell you what I can and can't answer, but let's just talk. Sometimes just by the questions that they ask, I have a sense of what's important to them about the work, what they know and maybe don't know based on how they ask the question. So I try to establish that psychological safety even in the interview. In the onboarding or integration process, we also look at how can we get the entire team to help with getting them prepared to contribute value. So as part of that, it might be a scrum master or an agile coach that starts things off, or manager that starts things off, but it's really looking at, okay, who can help them with this part of the code base? Who can set them up with this testing tool? And every stand up asking somebody on the team, who can help out with this? And who can get this person ready to go? And so there's this culture of helping each other out every time somebody new comes on. Now that even extends between teams as well. So if you can set a working agreement between teams that if somebody externally asks a question, respond as quick as you can, because the next time it might be you asking the question of another team. So try to have that common courtesy to ask the question of, we're trying to integrate to your system, something's not right, can you give us a pointer, tell us, you know, what are we missing, or where are we missing it in online documentation? So just setting that expectation or that organizational working agreement of, can you quickly help?
Well, and you even talk about the concept of language, right, and how important language is in these settings. And you have some examples in the book that really stood out to me as things that, man, I would get busted for saying all the time if somebody kept track. But simple things, right? Like the relative language around where you're located of, you know, it's tonight for me, tomorrow for you, it's early, it's late. Can you talk about the impact that that has in building that collaborative setting for the team?
So when we kind of extend this this humanness towards the other person, we actually end up realizing how much we need it ourselves. So one of the things I really like to think about in working agreements is, what do we need from the team? What can we offer to the team? And how can we talk about the work and our context in a way that makes total sense? So one of the principles is assume good intent. And we use some examples that actually happened to me years and years ago. I was working as a tester on a team. Somebody said to me, "When will you be done with that, JR?" And I said, "You know, if you'd given it to me earlier, I would be done now." Mark knows that tone of voice. Probably everybody knows that tone of voice. And the problem is, I snapped at that person because that was not what they meant. They literally meant, you know, given what you know now, when might you be done? And I was perturbed at getting what I thought of as late. I was perturbed with a whole bunch of stuff about this part of the product. I didn't see release notes. I didn't know who it was for. I mean, I was, just call me perturbed. And when we take that out on other people, we don't help other people feel safe. And one of the things that actually happens, and I really like to do, is say, I am going to ask for help if I think I don't have what I think of as entry criteria for the work. I will ask for help if I'm stuck for more than 15 minutes or whatever we agree to as a team. But let's make it possible to openly collaborate. And that openness is a real piece of psychological safety.
Well, so I was going to add to that a story from our team, which I don't think we've told this one before. No, Joanna's cringing. But
for $20, Joanna, I'll take it out in post-production.
Oh, no, leave it in.
So sometimes as part of that psychological safety, it's just allowing people to vent. So just giving people a safe way to do that with no repercussions. So as I mentioned, we, as a writing team, we would do daily check-ins. Sometimes toward the end of a difficult week, one of us would have to vent. It was usually on a Friday. And so it became this sort of unspoken working agreement that Fridays are for venting and that's okay. So,
well, and for swearing, because
I like it.
I wasn't
going to tell that part, but you know, okay.
I learned how to sail as a young child. I have a sailor's mouth. And especially if we were working at 4:30 on a Friday afternoon. Yeah.
I'm curious, Tiara. So the exchange that you described, you know, if you'd given it to me sooner, I'd be done sooner. Was that voice communication or written?
It was an email.
Do you remember?
Even worse, it was an email. So I had none of the cues around the question, right? So one of the things that Mark and I talk about a lot is the various kinds of communication channels people might use on a team. And email is the least, well, I think it's actually the least full. It's certainly not rich in natural communication, and it's often asynchronous. So we have none of the music with the words.
Right. So that brings me to another line of inquiry, the value of FaceTime, whether it's video, where you see from the neck up and you, who knows what percentage of connection that helps or eliminates. But so you got distributed teams. There's always the idea, somebody has a great idea, we should all get together in the same place, the same city, whether it's your place, their place, or some central ground. And then the argument is that's too expensive. So let's talk a little bit about the value of face-to-face time versus the perceived cost. When it's good, when it's absolutely necessary, and if there's any cases where it's not of value.
Can I take that, Mark, to start?
Oh, please.
Thank you.
And I have probably more to add there.
So if you want a well-functioning distributed agile team and you want fast cycle time, so you can keep the cost of the project down and you can see MVPs and MBEs and whatever it is you want as minimums as fast as you want them, then the fastest thing you can do is help people learn how to work together. And right now, the only way I know how to help people learn together is by getting them in one place for a week or two. We have several options in the book for what you might do for that first week and the second week. And a lot of managers have said to me in the past, that's just too expensive. And so I say, what's the cost of a defect? What's the cost of this project? What's the cost of delay for not having the work done when you need it done? They are thinking about money as an expense instead of thinking about money as value. And when you start to think about money as value, that money allows you to make certain decisions and give you options as opposed to just cost something, now all of a sudden things really change.
Yeah. And what is the cost of attrition when your staff gets frustrated by the distributed environment you've created instead of embracing it? That is another huge cost. So I think I can speak for Johanna in saying that it's always a good idea to get people together. As a matter of fact, for the company I'm at now, we are planning our annual gathering. We're going to have well over 200 people. We're running it as an open space, so they own the conference. So it is a 3-day conference, and it's going to be at least two days of open space where everyone in the organization is driving that agenda. Also, it's not just about talking about work, where it's about how can they connect while they're there. So we have, I think we talk in the book about some of the different channels you might have in chat. And we used to have the lounge where people could talk about just anything they wanted to. Well, now we have special interest groups, and I've lost count how many there are. We have parenting special interest groups. We have DIY special interest groups. And surprise, we have a gaming special interest group, including board games and video games. And so as part of the meetup that we're planning, we have to provide space for that as well. Oh, and we have a coffee group they like to call themselves the coffee snobs. And so as part of that, they like to bring their favorite coffees and have a session where they're talking about their favorite ways of grinding and brewing coffee. So we provide space for that as well. You have to provide that time to connect.
Mark, you started off by talking about the importance of inspect and adapt in everything we do from an Agile perspective. So I'd be remiss if I didn't ask, will retrospectives be part of your time? And if not, how do you tackle that if you're not face-to-face?
I don't know how to make this work without retrospectives. I'll put it that way. Now, the retrospectives, though, may not be exactly what some of your listeners are familiar with. So certainly, you know, we have tools out there now that allow us to do some of those retrospectives. But one of the things I realized going back to principles are, what are retrospectives for? It's for the team to look at how to work better together, how to build that better work environment, how to deliver value faster. So having a meeting with a certain frequency is one approach to do that. What one of my teams did, and we tell part of this story, I think, in the book, is they decided that a lot of the things that they were inspecting and adapting were very small. And so they would just have a weekly check-in they would have a bunch of small topics. They would have a special chat channel where they would keep a list of these things. And they'd do their stand-up for about 10 minutes, and they'd hit a lot of these short topics for about another 10 minutes every week. Now, any topic that looked like it was meatier, it was going to take long, okay, that's for the retrospective. So what that gave them was very quick adjustments every week, and then they would hold their retrospectives every 4 to 6 weeks, sometimes closer to a release of one of the products. This particular team handles several small products. And so as soon as a new release went out, that's usually when they would hold a longer retrospective of 90 minutes or a couple hours. And sometimes we would do it in multiple parts. Some would also be asynchronous as well as synchronous. So that's another variation. So take advantage of the distributed space. Don't get locked into using those same practices the same way.
You talked about building a regular cadence that varies depending on the team needs. What else adapts in terms of practices when we're not physically co-located? How else do we build and maintain momentum when we're not in the same room or even in the same time zone?
So I'll jump in that one. So we talked before about when you might not have sufficient overlap with a product owner. So what can you do in that case? Let's say that a team is working through a few stories. So can you have one team member that owns the story? So they're not a product owner, they're not a proxy for a product owner, but can they own the story? And if it breaks down into other stories, can they help keep track of that and keep the team and the rest of the product owner informed? So that's another adaptation that you might try as a way of rotating this ownership. So this way you've got somebody that's kind of keeping track of, okay, this is the larger story or epic, if you want to use that term. They also have a better understanding of the why. So they're making sure the rest of the team understands why this is important. And they're coordinating with the product owner to say, you know, this one's going well, or, you know, we're going to have some issues. We need to look at giving the team a little more time on this one. Or we might adjust what our minimum viable feature, or however, you know, whatever your favorite phrase is on that.
Joanna, anything to add? Are there practices that are ripe for adaptation?
So I find that the difference between a cadence and a time box or an iteration in Scrum is a really big thing. It does not seem to matter if I work with distributed or co-located teams these days. Almost every team is supposed to work on several products at one time plus support. And I, to be honest, I don't know how you do that in an iteration. I don't know how you plan for it. I don't know how you organize it. I mean, I might just be stupid, but I'm kind of not that stupid. So I understand what I do for my work. And I find that a cadence, especially the fewer hours of overlap a team has, is much more effective than a strict time box, which is what an iteration is. So, and then you can make a shorter cadence. So you can plan less, but more often. You can reflect less at one time, but inspect and adapt more often. You can get feedback from your users about this design or this particular problem for a smaller chunk, but more often. And the more I work in this space, the less I find that an iteration-based approach to any team works at all. We are supposed to do so much. In fact, every time I hear do more with less, I think, oh my God, we need Kanban. Because the managers can't actually see what the flow of the work is. And the more we think about that, the more we are supposed to, you know, do more with less. And the fewer hours of overlap, the more the team needs to see its value stream, needs to see its cycle time, needs to see everything that all the possible data that will help them make better decisions. So that's really where I'm coming from.
You guys have both offered us so many great examples of all of these practices as you applied them to pulling this book together, which I think has been really a neat context for thinking about some of this. Were there any practices that you changed as you went through the book process or that surprised you that wasn't something that you had coached or thought of before?
So the story I told about the retrospective and the short, what the team referred to as Kaizen events, that was theirs. I didn't come up with that. So they surprised me with that one. But I was talking to them about, you know, don't assume everything has to be synchronous. Don't assume everything has to happen on the same time box. So we were having the conversations Johanna and I were having, we were also having with the team. That's also where this idea of a story lead kind of came around, so that you wouldn't have to have this huge planning meeting where you're trying to get everyone together in one virtual room, which usually I find does not work that well. But if you can delegate out, if you can trust people to actually own parts of the system that's being built, I find that works well. And that was another one that I did not come up with. A product owner came up with that idea. One, because it was spread too thin, but I was actually skeptical at first. I was actually kind of fighting them on it at first. But what I found was it was working. For some team members, it did not work well. For others, they were like, yeah, this helps me really understand, you know, wrap my head around why we're doing this. So for some it worked, for some it didn't. We made it, we at least had everyone rotate around the role once, and then it was optional after that. And so certain team members that took to it, guess what? We now have new product owners. They ended up becoming product owners because they liked having that big picture view.
And if I can add one thing that surprised me, so for my work as a consultant, I have my big picture plans, which are kind of yearly, and then I break that down into quarterly goals, and then monthly, more specific stuff, and then I do rolling wave planning for every week. We did not do that for this book. We created a book frame, which guided our thinking, and then for every chapter, we started off with a map. A map of the user journey for every chapter, which sounds kind of like what a product owner might do. And then we didn't stick to it. We answered a bunch of the questions in that map, but then we moved stuff around, which is exactly what you do in a book. And to be honest, it's a lot of what you do in a product.
Absolutely.
Yeah, what I found surprising is we did not use a single iteration of anything. We time boxed our writing because we only had an hour every day, but we stayed in flow for every single thing that we did, and we always finished a chunk. And there might have been a couple times at the very end when we were pulling things together from all over where we did not actually finish a given chunk every day, but almost every day we finished a chunk, and that allowed us to then stay in flow and not have to break to do more planning for the next chunk of time. So we stayed in flow the entire time.
I'll add to that, another thing that surprised me was we wanted feedback, and so we released sections of the book and chapters and got feedback, but it really surprised me all the really thoughtful feedback we got. So we knew we hit some of the right target audience, but at the same time, having some readers that were Agile coaches, Agile practitioners, they also understood the value of feedback. And so, you know, some were very specific and some were like, you know, this chapter should go over toward the front. And we listened to some of that feedback, and that's why chapter 3 is where it is now. So
I think that's a good place to wrap things up. I want to give you both a chance to share any upcoming events, give some shout outs. Where are you going to be in the merry month of May?
I think I'm finally not traveling as much in May. But we are doing a session about the other 7 principles. So there are 8 principles in this book. And the first one is establish acceptable hours of overlap, which you might or might not be able to do with your team. But the other 7 principles, we are doing a joint session at the Agile 2019 conference. And I will be doing a bunch of sessions at the UberConf in Denver, Boulder. Go to Denver and drive north for an hour, whatever. Colleen is laughing at me. Because that's kind of where she lives, and she, you know, Boston geography, yeah, not so much.
And Mark, what do you got going on in your neck of the woods in the Orlando area or elsewhere?
So we have several sessions coming through Agile Orlando, where we're in the midst of planning the Agile Open Florida Conference. So that's an open space conference for people across the state of Florida. I personally will also be speaking at Mile High Agile on facilitating distributed teams. Yes, so I'll see Colleen there. And I've already seen her wonderful presentation. So for those who are going to that conference, go see Colleen's presentation and mine. There you go. We'll plug both. So looking forward to delivering that as well.
Good. So you gave Colleen a little plug there. Colleen, you got anything else going on in May?
That is it for me. I'm winding down the school year. So I'm excited that everybody's coming to me. Yeah, definitely hit Mile High. I know there's still tickets available, and we can offer a 10% code, a 10% discount code in our show notes as well.
Great. Well, Joanna Rothman and Mark Kilby, it's been a delight to talk to you. Thank you. And thank you to our listening audience. If this is your first time joining in, welcome. Subscribe. You'll get the next one. If you'd like to join the discussion and share the stories about distributed teams and what works for you and your best practices for sharing virtual craft beers and coffee amongst geographically dispersed team members, hop on over to coalition.agileuprising.com. And finally, support from listeners just like you help us cover our hosting production costs. See the show notes for how you become a patron. Until next time, this is the Agile Uprising Podcast, signing out.